They say, the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It is 9:07 Wednesday, September 7th. So it's 9:07:97. Perfect. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News.
Good morning. I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News. Shameless plug here. And I don't do this enough. You can catch me and Dave Johnson every Saturday on Sirius XM Radio for the Down the Stretch show from 10 to 1 Eastern on Channel 85.
Hi, and coming off the bench as the utility infielder of sorts, I'm Randy Moss with NBC Sports, and pleased to be with you guys.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. Don't forget, how could you forget? We're only 5 days away from the Keeneland September sale. It runs September 12th through the 24th. You can check out the catalog with over 4,100 yearlings at the worldsyearlingsale.com. All right, so John Green, our good friend who has helped build this show into what it is, has stepped down from the show, unfortunately, and we're going to miss John. I want to thank him for his hard work and his dedication to the show, which honestly would not have become what it is without him. And John and my working relationship has turned into a friendship, and I appreciate him, and that's only going to continue. So shout out to John, and thank him for all his work, and I'll talk to you soon, buddy. But we have a ton to talk about on the racetrack, and we're so grateful that Randy Moss is here, our good buddy, who's sat in for John and me and Bill a couple of times. Flightline could honestly deserve – he deserves the whole show, I think, because of how impressive he was and how impressive he's been as a racehorse. And, you know, I want to defer to Bill and Randy because they've seen a lot more racing than I have. It's a very polite way of calling them old. So they have a lot more opportunity, a lot more ability to put this into context. So I'm going to toss it to them and try to figure out where this ranks on their all-time great list. And then we'll go back to me. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, thank you for that reference to how old I am, John. Excuse me, Joe. I really appreciate it. Yeah, because I did see Secretariat run in person. And believe it or not, I know there's a million people that say this, but I was in the stands for the 1973 Belmont, the greatest performance in the history of horse racing. Let's take a look at a couple different areas of this. First of all, you know, people trying to compare them to Secretariat or horses from other generations. I just don't think you can do that. It's just too different. It's the proverbial apples to oranges. You're coming out of a horse like Secretariat is coming out of an era where horses ran every 2-3 weeks, ran 20 times a year, something like that. He also ran in the Triple Crown, which, of course, Flightline didn't get a chance to do that. I have no problem comparing to contemporary horses. You like to talk about, Joe, a lot about Go Sapper. And I think right now he's superseded Go Sapper. He's a better horse than that, and that's saying an awful lot. But as I wrote in my weekend review this week, the thing that I wanted to compare was Secretariat's Belmont to Flightline's Pacific Classic. And in my long, long life, those are the two most impeccable, dominating, impressive performances that I've ever seen. And there was a lot of similarities between the two of them. I mean, I don't think any horse will ever do what Secretariat did that day on the track, will ever. You know, that was just one of those things out from another universe. You know, how can a horse actually do this sort of thing? But I thought this was the best performance I have seen since Secretariat's Belmont. And in many ways, the races were very similar, the way they developed, the way he just crushed his opponents. So, you know, that's, you know, people may think it's blasphemy. And how, wait a minute, another Secretariat, another horse that had a Secretariat-like performance. Well, if it's true, why not say it? You know, don't worry about overhyping something. You know, it literally was something like Trevor Denman said in his call. I didn't think I'd ever see anything like this again the rest of my life. I just thought, you know, that for a horse to go out and to dominate grade one competition, win by almost 20 lengths, pulled up under the wire, was just something that was beyond the abilities of any horse out there. You know, this is a Babe Ruth type thing. This is a Michael Jordan type thing. This is, well, not maybe once in a lifetime because I lived during Secretariat's era, but maybe a twice in a lifetime thing. You know, it's almost hard to describe.
I wasn't at Secretariat's Belmont. I was watching from my living room. Kudos to Bill for actually being there in the grandstand. But I share your opinion, Bill, that this is the single most devastating performance that I've seen on the racetrack, either in person or on TV, since Secretariat's Belmont Stakes. You know, I mean, so many people now judge the level of a horse's performance by numbers, by speed figures, whether it be buyer speed figures or any other speed figures. And yeah, you can look back 126 for Flightline in the Pacific Classic. Okay. Ghost Zapper got a 128 in the Islin in 2004, but against a four-horse field on a sloppy track and against a horse that never really was a great Presidential Affair. There was a nice horse, but was never really a grade one level horse to begin with. Whereas Flightline beats horses that were a couple of grade one winners, a couple of grade two winners, a grade three winner. 19 lengths. Yes. So Secretariat wins by 31 in the Belmont Stakes, but at a mile and a half. Flightline wins by 19 at a mile and a quarter and was still widening on the field behind him with every strike. Assuming that he could continue that going a mile and a half, and there's no reason to think he wouldn't, what would the margin of victory have been for Flightline if he had been able to keep going out to a mile and a half? So it, to some people, it may be heresy, but as good as American Pharoah was, the darling of horse racing in the last 20 years, even his Breeders' Cup Classic, I don't think matches the kind of performance that we saw Flightline give in the Pacific Classic. When Arrowgate met his untimely demise, Bob Baffert said that he believed that Arrowgate's race in the Dubai World Cup, where he was left at the gate and still scored a dominating win, that he would have given Secretariat all he could handle on that day. I don't think that performance even stacks up to what we saw in the Pacific Classic. It was just unbelievable. You know, now the question is going to transition to what happens next. Will he indeed run in the Breeders' Cup Classic? That's what they say. What happens next year when the stud deal is announced, which, you know, will have to be just astronomical. I think the story of Flightline is developing still, but I'm in awe of the rest.
I know. It's like there's not enough superlatives to really describe what we saw on Saturday. And you can just tell from the buzz, like even just on racing Twitter, just the reactions. It was just hours and hours of people reposting the replay. And you cannot blame them because it was just so incredible. And, you know, Randy makes a good point about like the speed figures and the way we measure greatness now. And there are plenty of tangible ways to measure his greatness: speed figures, pace figures, raw final times, margin of victory. But to me, the thing that sets him apart most is intangible. And it's the fact that every single time he runs, the expectations are through the roof. And he manages to exceed those expectations every single time. That is what's so impressive to me is I'm sure people were expecting him to win by 10, 12, 15 lengths, and he beat that. And it does look and it feels viscerally like Secretariat's Belmont in the way that he kept widening on the turn. And Bill made a good point in this week in review that, you know, maybe this is the distance he wanted all along, this and further. You know, we assume just because that's all he had run so far, he was a 6-furlong, one-turn horse. But now look at him. And you know, who knows if the Breeders' Cup Classic were a mile and a half, you could win it by 30 lengths. He could post that Secretariat type performance. And, you know, you mentioned Ghost Zapper. Ghost Zapper is the only comparison for me in my lifetime as a racing fan, talent-wise. But the thing about Ghost Zapper is he was not this through five starts. He had not accomplished nearly as much as Flightline had. He was not as fast as Flightline has been through five starts. So that kind of brings us to the question of whether or not we're going to see Flightline as much as we saw Ghost Zapper, which was 11 times. You know, even if Flightline comes back next year, maybe we won't see him total 11 times for his career. But, you know, we're going to have Costa Hieronis on the show a little bit later, and we're going to beg him, Bill. We're going to beg him to bring Flightline back as a 5-year-old, because if there were ever a horse that kind of, I'm not going to say obligated, but you had a little bit of, what's the little bit low obligation, Randy? You guys are journalists. Like, just a little bit of a need to give back to the racing public. This is the horse. Everybody who ever spends a cent on a racehorse is praying to get a horse like this because they love the game. That's why they spend all the money. So to get a horse like this and to only run him 6 times in his career, to me, would feel like a little bit of a waste and it would be a little bit unsatisfying. I mean, I'm assuming you guys agree with me, but can you expand on that a little bit at all?
Yeah, I mean, Joe, all good points, and we'll know more later on when we talk to Costa Hieronis. Hopefully, we'll know more. Brandy, unless you know something I don't know, I don't see any reason why it wouldn't run in the Breeders' Cup. I mean, you know, I can't see pulling the plug on him at this point like they did with Justify after the Belmont. But, you know, this is going to be a big issue. And, you know, if the Breeders' Cup is his last start, and I still think it will be, then, yeah, a career of six races. And as brilliant as they've been as a racing fan, which we all are, I definitely feel cheated that we only got to see this horse six. Now, I know it's not 1954. We're not going to see a horse like this run 35 times. But just six, that would really be something that I think everybody would leave. Not a bad taste in your mouth, because I don't want to rain on this parade in any way, shape, or form, but something that would be less than satisfying. From a financial standpoint and a bottom line standpoint, it's the right move. Joe, you're more, or maybe Randy can jump in this too. I mean, what's his stud fee first right off the bat? 150, 200,000, something like that. I mean, it's going to be astronomical, the amount of money they can make breeding this horse. But yeah, you're right, Joe. You know, that's one thing that horse racing has lost over the years, when the major stables were, you know, the wealthy families, the Vanderbilts, the Mellons, the Phipps. And they looked at this not as a business, but they looked at this as a sport. And we've lost that in horse racing. I mean, only the Phipps family is still around among the group that I've mentioned. And, you know, everybody looks at this as a business. But here's the thing. Like you said, everybody waits a lifetime to get a horse like this. And it's only going to happen to a handful of people. So this is what you've always wanted. Why then would you say six starts were done? And then, you know, as much money as you can make breeding the horse, is it really that much fun? Is it that exciting? Is it a thrill? Is it something that you've lived your whole life for and worked for? I do detect that, you know, and I just, as a matter of fact, when I was writing my weekend review, I said, well, this will be, Breeders' Cup will be his last start. And I'm glad I look back at some of the notes that came out of Delmar, where John Sadler was saying, you know, hold your horses here. No decisions have been made. And I don't think he would say that unless that was the case, that the ownership group is leaving the door open a crack. And yeah, you know, look, at the end of the day, Hronis, West Point, and the 72 other people and partnerships that own them and something, you know, do they owe racing something? Well, yes and no. Do they have to bring them back? No. But just like you said, would somebody say something like you just said, you know what, no matter what happens, we're going to make $1 zillion off this horse. Let's do something special for the sport. And not only bring them back next year, but run them, wow, what's a major campaign this day and age, run them six times next year, something like that. Let's hope that they do. Until we read the press release that he's been retired and going to blank stud farm, let's hold out hope.
Look, I think, you know, obviously the three of us would love to see Flightline come back and run next year, and as would every racing fan in America. I'm not going to say there's a 0% chance, but I think there is a very low percentage chance that we will see Flightline come back next year. I mean, think of all the colossal stud deals that we've seen in the last decade or two. Now you've got a horse that we're talking about is turning in performances better than any horse that we've seen since Secretariat. And this horse has a pedigree as such that he brought $1 million as a yearling by Tappet out of Feathered, who was a really good racehorse herself. This horse checks all the boxes. And I think this stud deal is going to be so massive that, you know, even if Costa Hronis, who I believe is the majority owner, even if he would love to bring this horse back and run next year, I don't think his partners would be all in on that. I know there were some comments made by Sadler and by Hronis that, hey, you may see this horse run next year. To me, as they're negotiating this stud deal, I think that's mainly a negotiating ploy. Hey, look, we would love to run this horse next year. If you don't want to run this horse next year, then let's see some more money on the table, right? Mm. But look, I don't like the economics of the sport the way they are right now with the tail wagging the dog. But unfortunately, it's reality. It is what it is right now. And this deal is just going to be so massive that I can't see any way they would put him on the track. Hope I'm wrong, though.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're probably not wrong. It's no doubt a losing proposition to bring him back as a five-year-old, you know, money-wise. Nothing he could do on the track next year could make his owners as much money as one stallion season at six figures a pop.
And about the Breeders' Cup Classic, no, I don't know anything about that, Bill. I haven't been told anything at all. I'm just being extremely cynical, okay? So this stud deal is announced.
Now, this sport? What are you kidding me?
I know. And it's like, I say the stud deal is announced in the next couple of weeks. And it's a mega, mega, mega stud deal, right? And I think we would probably all agree that if Fightline never runs another race, he's going to win the Eclipse Award as the champion older horse based on what he's done so far this year. He might even be horse of the year, right? Who knows? You would get the whole risk reward thing coming into play. Suddenly there's a little minor injury and Flightline can't run in the Breeders' Cup Classic. That's extremely cynical. I understand. And I hope to heck we do see him in the Breeders' Cup Classic. I think probably we will, but it wouldn't shock me if we didn't.
Yep. And like you said, there's probably a slim chance he comes back next year. But like I said, you spend all this money and all this time and put in all this legwork in the game, working the sales to get a horse that like this that we may not see again for 50 years, 100 years, maybe never again, like Trevor Denman said. I get the business realities of it. I get all that it's, more money than anybody could realistically ever turn down. But what's it all for if the horse is only going to run a half dozen times? But we'll leave that alone. Like Bill said, I don't want to rain on the parade because, it was special. It was the kind of performance that gives you goosebumps. And, I think reminds you why you're a racing fan, because it was just your jaw hit the floor watching him run around that far turn. And he just gets better and better and better. And he's poetry in motion to watch. Go ahead, Randy.
And the counterpoint about the Classic, it is a $6 million race and he'll be 3-5.
There you go. How often does that happen?
That's a lot of money.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. We're finally just a few days away from the start of the 2022 Keeneland September sale. We have a few major updates to share after this weekend. Hip 11, a son of Uncle Mo, is a half-brother to Grade 1 hopeful winner Forte, we'll talk about in a little bit. And he sells with Bluegrass Thoroughbred Services. Hip 493 is the American Pharaoh half-brother to Grade 1 Jockey Club Gold Cup winner Olympiad. He sells with Gainsway. Hip 297 is the full sister to Grade 2 Prioress winner Wicked Halo, daughter of Gunrunner, also sells with Gainsway. In Chris McGrath's latest installment of the Breeders' Spotlight Series presented by Keeneland, he spoke with Bobby Flay, shout out to Bobby, friend and fan of the show, on his breeding program, as well as his Keeneland September offerings, which include three Book One offerings in Hip 115 and Uncle Mo Colt, that's a half-brother to champion Pizza Bianca. Hip 131, an Uncle Mo Philly, who's from the family of champion Misty for me. And hip 191, a Quality Road Philly out of graded winner Cover Song. You can find the story at the TDN. It's called Flay's Recipe for Turf Success. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
When the thoroughbred world descends upon Lexington this November, there is one place you need to be. The place where history comes alive with every championship victory.
He's authentic indeed!
The place where the future is built with the fall of a gavel. The place that exists to be the heart of this industry. The center of it all. Home to the November Breeding Stock Sale and the 2022 Breeders' Cup, Keeneland.
He was just put together like a machine, and he had a great mind. Everything about him was what you'd want.
Tis the Law pops the cork in the champagne.
Tis the Law is going to win the first leg of the Triple Crown.
I've never seen him get tired.
Respect the Law. Tis the Law.
His structure is just perfect. His bone is perfect.
He's left the others behind. He's going to win the Run Happy Travers.
He's everything you would look for in a horse.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Coolmore. Justify got his third TDN Rising Star on Saturday when Champion's Dream, very well bet in that race, broke his maiden on debut at Saratoga for Danny Gargan and Rose Down Racing Stables. Sire of three graded stakes winners and four stakes winners, Justify is also the sire of 12 winners, which is second best of any freshman sire in North America. And fellow freshman sire, Motown, had a juvenile double on Labor Day with Mo Trump winning at Finger Lakes. And then Play the Music, breaking her maiden on debut at Kentucky Downs. With these two new winners, Motown now has eight winners from his first crop. Son of Uncle Mo stands at Ashford for $7,500. All right, so it wasn't just Flightline over the weekend. We had a lot of other good action, obviously closing weekend at Saratoga. We had the Jockey Club Gold Cup card. Jockey Club Gold Cup was won by my boy Olympiad, although I jumped off of him and on Better Things, I was against him and he made me look like a fool. I just didn't think he wanted to go a mile and a quarter. Didn't think he was going to bounce back that quickly from the Whitney, but he looked great. Got a 105 buyer. But I just, he's one of those horses now that I think in any other year would probably be like cruising to a championship. But in this particular year with Flightline and to a lesser extent, Life Is Good, is he even going to be on the podium for Horse of the Year? Definitely for older dirt male. But, you know, he's had a very impressive campaign, 6-for-7 now, got that elusive grade one win. He had only won a grade two before that. And then the other big race at Saratoga was Virginia Joy upsetting Warlike Goddess in the Flower Bowl. 120, guys, for 6 furlongs in that race. It reminds me of those old Belmont turf marathons. Are there no rabbits anymore? Chat enters these rabbits that end up winning these grade one races. I don't get why Warlike Goddess did not have a rabbit in that race, but Virginia Joy managed to just hold her off. Obviously, we had the two-year-old races. We had Forte winning the grade one hopeful. And then in the spinaway on Sunday, had an upset, Phil Serpy. Shout out to Phil Serpy. First grade one win in 29 years. Leave No Trace wins the spinaway at 14-1. What else stood out from the weekend to you guys?
Well, you know, one more point. Olympiad wins the Jockey Club Gold Cup, one of the most prestigious races in the country, a grade one. And nobody even knew the race existed, hardly, because what? Oh, there was another race that happened that day besides Flightline. You know, I give Mott credit. You know, like so many other trainers, after he ran a clunker in the Whitney, we'll train up to the Breeders' Cup and see you then. But yeah, the importance for this horse, and I would be almost certain this went into their thinking, was he needed a grade one win for his stallion career, because isn't that all that really matters in this day and age? And, you know, as good a horse as he is, it's unlikely that he's going to win the Breeders' Cup Classic against Flightline, the greatest horse, of course, in Secretariat. So, you know, Mott went a little bit outside the box or conventional thinking to bring him back in the Jockey World Cup. And he was back. I don't know what happened to him in the Whitney, John. I'm sorry. You were his biggest fan. You jumped off the bandwagon. Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
I wanted a hat. I wanted some merch. But when we had merch, they never said it to me. So.
Yeah. So, you know, good for them. And you know, but again, your point being, in other years, you know, might even be number one for the Horse of the Year race with all he's accomplished this year, even with only one grade one. But, you know, some of those races, particularly Stephen Foster, were really, really top notch races. He can run in 1.25 miles. So, you know, what is the margin of defeat to him in the Breeders' Cup Classic? Will he come within 10 lengths of Flightline? And, you know, another story, and I'll move on to Randy because I don't have too much else to say about the weekend. But another story coming out of this. Now, Mott has said, yes, I'm going in the Breeders' Cup Classic. But even though it is a $6 million race, well, some people duck Flightline. For instance, we're waiting to see what the Life Is Good connections do when, you know, you're going to be in a virtually impossible situation in the Breeders' Cup Classic, and you would be 3-5 in the Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile if you decide to go in that direction. So, thanks for reminding me there was another race last week, and I almost forgot.
Well, we obviously on NBC, we did the Jockey Club Gold Cup and the Flower Bowl. And while we, you know, don't actively root for any horses, obviously, it was nice, I thought, to see Olympiad win and see the ownership and the trainer rewarded for actually running their horse and not sitting on them and, you know, training, as Bill said, up to the Breeders' Cup Classic. I think I know what happened to him in the Whitney. I mean, in his win streak, his 5-race win streak leading up to the Whitney, every race looked identical, right? He used his tactical speed to get into a perfect spot going into the first turn, relax nicely into second. But the horses that he was tracking were Silver Prospector, Wayburn, horses that were not grade one horses and not even possibly grade two horses at 1.8 miles. And as a case, Saturday, 1.25 miles. And suddenly in the Whitney, he's tracking Life Is Good. And he goes to make his little spurt that he always makes at about the half mile pole that gets him right up to the leader and gets him right into the race and engaged. And he tries to make that little spurt and he can't even make up an inch. Right. And Alvarado hits him with the whip underhanded and it doesn't do any good. And at that point, I think the horse just said, "The heck with this." Right. I'm over my head. Saturday, he's chasing Tax. So he's right back with his friends again and is able to run the same kind of race he did before. And I thought it was an outstanding effort. I don't think, though, that it puts him in the top two or three choices when you look to the Breeders' Cup Classic. As far as the Flower Bowl is concerned, what I don't think Warlike Goddess lost anything in defeat. Given the way the race was run, given the traffic that she had, given the pace the way it was, you know, 119 and change, almost 120. Watching the race from the NBC set, just me and my broadcast colleague and my great friend, Jerry Bailey. So we're watching the race live, and the field turns to come into the stretch for the first time. And Joel Rosario and Warlike Goddess is down on the inside. And Jerry's talking to the TV set, and he's saying, all right, ease her out, ease her out, ease her out. And he goes the inside route up into the traffic. And Jerry's like, no, 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 don't do that. Don't do that. Don't fall for that bait. But sure enough, that's exactly what happened. And the horse was buried in traffic until really it was too late. And I thought she gave a nice closing spurt to get what she got. I think she is the best turf horse in America, male or female. Whether that means she's good enough to beat the Europeans in the Breeders' Cup turf, we'll see who they bring over. Again, I don't think she lost anything in defeat. And one more note, you mentioned in your breeding segment the Danny Gargan first-time starter by Justify that won, you know, three maiden special weight races on Saturday alone, which is one of the beauties of Saratoga. You see these fantastic two-year-olds. Jerry and I happened to run into Danny Gargan, the first trainer we saw at the Oklahoma side at Saratoga on Friday morning, and he was watching his horses train, and we chatted with him for a little bit, and he said, I am really looking forward to these maiden special weight races on Saturday. I never win with first-time starter two-year-olds, almost never, but he said, I am really looking forward to these races on Saturday, and after his horse ran and won, I think we know why.
Well, yeah, there was a Brad Cox horse who looked really good too. Instant Coffee also won at like 14-1. That horse got a big figure, I think, like a relatively big figure, got an 85, I believe. Yeah, I mean, watching that Warlike Goddess race as someone who like singled her and everything, I had a sinking feeling on the far turn that he was going to get stuck in traffic. And when I saw the three quarter split, I just laughed. I just burst out laughing seeing 119 and change. It reminded me, I'm sure you guys remember this, 2004, the Lone Star Breeders' Cup, which I always remember because it was Ghost Sapper, mm-hmm. Ouija Board was the big horse who won the filly and mare turf. But the course was like a bog, and they went like 121 for 6 furlongs. That's what it reminded me of. But yeah, I mean, you're right that she lost nothing in defeat, and she has that's a really big closing kick she has, and it wasn't enough this time. But yeah, I agree. It's hard for me to think of a horse that I would trust more than her, male or female, in the turf division in America. And, you know, she ran great last year in the Breeders' Cup. I thought she was an underlay last year, frankly, as the favorite in the Breeders' Cup, but I thought she ran great. She was a close third. I mentioned the two-year-old races. Let's come back to Flatline for a second. So I have one more question I wanted to ask you guys. You got a 126 buyer, ran 159-1. He was wrapped up on at the 16th pole. There's debate sometimes about this, about how much faster horses can run when they're wrapped up like that. And it's a visual thing. It's hard to quantify. What do you guys think? Do you think he could have run significantly faster if Flavien had really pushed him out to the wire? Or do you think he was already going basically as fast as he could go?
Well, I'm going to wonder if Randy's ever asked Jerry Bailey that, because he would be the perfect person to answer. I don't know, Joe. I really don't. Isn't it logical that, yes, he could have? I mean, if you're a human runner and you're in a mile race and, you know, you're so far out in front that in the last 200 yards, you sort of jog to the wire, isn't that going to affect your time and the margin of victory? You know, could he have won by 25, 26 lengths? I don't really know. Again, I'd like to hear what Flavien Prat has to say about that. That is one of the things that I wrote, too. I hope in the Breeders' Cup, they just let him roll. Let him just, you know, let him win by 30, you know, make the goal the 31 lengths, the magic number. I mean, I don't think he's going to win the Breeders' Cup by 31 lengths, but it's, you bring up a very interesting point, and not being somebody who's ever sat on a horse in my entire life, I don't have the faintest idea. And I want to go up before we get to Randy. I want to go off on a tangent here a little bit. We're talking about Danny Gargan and Secretariat and all that. I have a trivia question. See if anybody can get this. In the 1973 Belmont Stakes, every single jockey in the race but one is a member of the Hall of Fame. Can you name the one rider in that race who is not in the Hall of Fame?
Wow. I don't know if I can name more than one rider in the race, period. So I'll leave that to Ray.
We got the usual suspects, Cordero, Velasquez. The answer to that question is Danny Gargan. This Danny Gargan's father, how about that?
Wow.
Wrote some long shot that ran last or something like that. Unless Sham was last, I don't remember. Mm. That is, you know, in Saratoga, maybe you can win a free round of drinks with that question.
Well, back to Joe's question, you know, I've sat on three thoroughbreds in my life and they didn't end well each time. but I have brought up that topic to Jerry Bailey, and we do have the same opinion on it. And his opinion and mine is this: when you have a horse as good as Flightline, what makes that horse so good is that they're intensely competitive and they want to run fast. They don't need the whip to run fast. They don't necessarily need to be pushed to try their best and to run their fastest. If visually, oftentimes when the jockey relaxes in the irons, it makes it look as if the horse could have run a lot faster. But my opinion and Jerry's is that unless the horse is actually physically restrained as the horses are coming to the wire, then maybe the horse can run a little faster, but usually it's negligible.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. Yeah, like it's such a good point that people watch the jockey in those cases more than the horse. You know, there are cases like that. Like I think of Jackie's Warrior and the Vanderbilt. He seemed like he was really being pulled up on in like the last eighth of a mile. But yeah, I think it's negligible. I think maybe he could have run 1 or 2 points faster. But like people saying like, oh, he could have run 158 if Flavian had let him run. Like, do you know how big of a difference that is? You know, 158 to 159 and one. That's like 10 lengths almost, you know, down the stretch. So I agree. I don't think he could have done that. But it's an interesting conversation. And yeah. I agree with Bill and his point in the Breeders' Cup Classic. If it is indeed his last race and he's opening up on the turn like he did in the Pacific Classic, send him. Just send like as an OBS March breeze and let him do what he can do.
I interviewed Eddie Maple one time when I was in the newspaper business for a column on Secretariat's last race. I think it's a Canadian International on the turf at Woodbine. And we've all seen the video. Maybe Bill was there watching it. I don't know. But we've all seen the video, the fog, you know, and how surreal it was. And Eddie told me, he said he knew it was going to be Secretariat's last race. And, you know, he was in against some really good turf horses. And he said he asked him a little bit going into the final turn, and the horse gave him this big response. And then he kind of eased up on him a little bit. And he told me as they were coming to the quarter pole, he said, you know, this is his last race. I'm just gonna see. And so he kind of nudged him a little bit, and he got this gigantic response from Secretariat at the quarter pole. And then he said, oh, okay. All right. He's got more anytime I want. Right.
Yep. Absolutely. Flightline seems like that horse too. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by the Pennsylvania Horse Breeders Association. The PHBA is looking forward to a big day of racing at Parks on Saturday, September 24th. It'll feature the next two legs of their PA-sired, PA-bred stakes series. The $200,000 Prince Lucky Stakes is for juveniles going 6.5 furlongs, and the $200,000 Imply Stakes is for the juvenile fillies going 6.5 furlongs. Also at Parks that day, they'll have the $200,000 Alphabet Soup Handicap going 1 1/16 on the turf, and the $200,000 Plum Pretty Stakes for fillies and mares going long on the dirt. I do believe that's Pennsylvania Derby Day as well. So it's a big race for the big open race that day that we're all looking forward to. So we'll be right back after this message from the PHBA.
Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet to detect gene doping in thoroughbreds. And we endorsed the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by XBTV. This week's XBTV Workout of the Week is Vegas Magic, who worked 5 furlongs in 1:04 at Del Mar on Saturday, which you can see on your screen. Right now, the 2-year-old is trained by Doug O'Neill. She's undefeated in her first 3 starts, most recently in the Grade 2 Sorrento Stakes. She's expected to make her next start this weekend in the Grade 1 Del Mar Debutante, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. If you want to see those 2-year-old works, I'm sure there's a bunch of 2-year-olds still yet to debut this year at Belmont and at Santa Anita. Just type in the horse's name in the search bar. XBTV has got over thousands of works. All the resources you need as a handicapper, as a scouter of horse flesh, go check it out. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So we're so thrilled to bring on this week the owner of a little horse named Flightline you might have heard of, Costa Hironas. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, I have to smile when you say Flightline. That just makes an automatic smile.
Yeah,
thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm smiling. I don't even own the horse. But yeah, I mean, it was impossible not to get chills just watching that race on Saturday. But I wonder what it felt like for someone who owns the horse. What was going through your mind, body, and soul on Saturday when you watched him come down that stretch?
You know, usually we're racing against the 1-5 and I'm trying to beat him. So like with Beholder and with Arrogate. So we were on the other side this time with the target on our back. So watching him in the mornings, every morning on Saturday, I felt pretty comfortable going into the race that if he could do his thing, we'd see some really good results. I don't think anybody expects 20 lengths, but yeah, we felt really good walking into the race, and we really like our horse.
Costa, thanks for joining us. So many, you know, great things to talk about. And one of the stories coming into the race was that, you know, if there was one little doubt about Flightline, it was the fact that he had never been two turns and never been beyond a mile. I think now, considering the way he ran and how well he did, can we make a case now that this is what he wanted all along, a mile and a quarter, and that maybe he was actually at, believe it or not, a disadvantage in those shorter races?
Yeah, I'm going to say he wasn't ready for this at that point. I mean, if you look at his workouts, if you look at the Juan Leyva who rides him every day and what he had to do just to keep him in check, you know, if you look at a workout video from a year ago versus like the last one at Del Mar, there's a huge difference. And I think John Sadler has done right by him by, instead of racing up to this mile and a quarter, he wanted to train him up to a mile and a quarter because he needed to learn how to rate, how to relax, and how to run up a mile and a quarter. And that's what the focus was, and that was the plan all along. So after the Met Mile, I think the whole thing was, how are we going to get him to really relax and be able to do the mile and a quarter? And I'll give John Sadler all the credit in the world for how he had this plan laid out, and his assistant trainer Juan Leyva, who's on Flightline's back, their plan to make him learn to rate, learn to relax, and be able to go that distance. That I got, they give them all the credit for teaching him to do that.
Well, Costa, when you had Accelerate won the Breeders' Cup Classic, you probably thought that was the horse of a lifetime, and now lo and behold, look at what you have now. Take us back to the very beginning, right, to the Saratoga sale when you have four other ownership partners in this horse. How did all that transpire?
So that was all David Engordo and Bill Farish. My wife, Stephanie, was back there for a TOBA meeting. So she was at the sale also, her first sale. So they were all talking in the back, and I was just getting phone calls to me and John Sadler, you know, we have this horse and you want to get in. And, you know, my focus is, you know, it's got to come to the West Coast. It's got to come to Sadler. So we can, you know, enjoy him and to be part of it. So we were very blessed that that Jane Lyons, you know, I'm sure she makes the big decisions here to who's going to be part of her horse. And so we're very blessed and honored that that Bill, David, and them, they all got together and we were included in the package.
So let's spin it forward now. Obviously, the next goal is the Breeders' Cup Classic, and I understand you guys want to take it one race at a time. But there were some comments Saturday after the race that suggested it's not out of the realm of possibility that he would come back as a five-year-old. Obviously, you're not making those decisions right now. But what goes into that deliberation? And if you had to put a percentage on it, what would you think the percentage is that he comes back and races again?
Okay, so just like Stellar Wind, which we probably left on the track an extra year, just like Accelerate, which it worked out great to leave him out because we had some multiple offers for them to both get retired and go start their second career. It's kind of always been the philosophy to, you know, they were born to be a racehorse. So let's let them do what they want to do as long as they want to do it. So I guess I can't really give you a percentage. You'd have to ask Flightline. But I really believe as long as he's healthy and happy with what he's doing and he still wants to go to the racetrack every day and be part of this and he still wants to, you know, run the way he runs and be who he is, I think there's a great possibility that we'll see him next year as a five-year-old.
Wow, that's the most exciting thing I've heard in a long time, Costa. And thanks so much for even giving it a thought, because in this day and age, people don't do that. Now, with so many different owners involved, and I don't know who owns what percentage of et cetera, how will this decision be made? Does everybody have a vote? Do people with more a higher percentage of the horse have a greater vote than people with a lower percentage? Take us through what will transpire between now and the time that decision is made.
As far as me personally, I think I'm gonna defer to Bill Farish and Jane Lyons, because they both are absolute experts at horse racing. I still consider myself kind of new. I've only been in for 11 years now. So as far as that second career, it's not something we're heavily involved in. So as far as the racetrack, I'm going to defer to John Sadler, and he's the man, and he's going to make the decisions. As far as that other career, I guess I'm going to defer to Bill Farish and Jane Lyon, and let them, you know, call the shots. And I'm just going to follow along. I'm going to be a good partner.
Mm-hmm. So Costa, I mean, Terry Finley at West Point Thoroughbreds, who kind of put the deal together at Saratoga, from what I understand, has been very close-lipped about who owns what percentage. Other than to say that Jane Lyon stayed in for 25%, the breeder of the horse. So obviously the other owners, West Point, Anthony Manganaro of Sienna Farm, Bill Farish of Woodford Racing. It's been said that you guys all get along fabulously, that it's a great group of guys and women from a personality standpoint. How is that going to play, you think, in the decision of whether or not to keep this horse on the track for another year?
I think everybody in the group's professional horsemen, and I think we're just going to do what's right by the horse. I think we have to defer to Flightline and John Sadler's expertise, and he's with him every day. He's going to know what's best for the horse, along with Flightline's going to give indications. So we'll just like Joe had said earlier, we're going to the Breeders' Cup, and then let's come out of the race and see how we do and just go to the next step. So I just think we get along really well. I'm a real respectful person, as you know. Like I said, I'm going to defer to the experts that really know this business best and what's best for him. But I race horses. You know, that's what I like to do. That's Horonis Racing. We're not in that after career very heavily. So.
Well, I mean, absolutely. And it's shocking to hear that you've only been in the game for 10 or 11 years, because you've had so much success and you've won owner's titles at Del Mar plenty of times. What is the operation like for you and your brother? Like, how hands-on are you in terms of managing the horses, in terms of watching workouts? Like, are you at the track all the time? What's it like for you guys?
I guess we manage the horse division the same way we manage the ranch here. I mean, we've got 2,400 people picking grapes today. So it's not something we can do, you know, by ourselves. So we manage managers. So I'm at John Sadler calls the shots. He's in charge. We talk a lot. I see him a couple times a week, you know, on the weekends, especially. And if there's anything going on, John's on the phone and we're talking, and we're always part of the equation and we're always involved. But the final say comes down. It's all about John Sadler and what's best for the horse.
Costa, you said that if he would come back next year, that would be something that would be good for you, because you love to watch these horses race and you're not really into it as a breeder. But having said that, from a strictly bottom line perspective, it's no matter which races he were to win, if he is to run next year, would not make as much money as he would as a stallion. Should owners, and I maybe it's tough to speak for the entire sport, but nonetheless, I'll pose this question to you. Should owners have an obligation or feel a sense of obligation to do what's right for the sport? And nothing under the let's do what's right for the sport banner could be more relevant than bringing a superstar back next year, especially a superstar that has such a limited career. Do you feel an owner should think about what's good for the game?
I guess you have to make your own individual decision and decide what's best for your barn and listen to the professionals. And I don't know, I guess everybody's a little different how they have to handle things. And I'm always respectful to that, whatever their situation is. And we don't know the inner workings of that particular horse the way the trainer's going to know and the owner. So I guess I'm always going to defer to let them, everybody's got to decide and do their own thing. So yeah, I'm sure everyone wants to do what's best by the sport at all times. We want to build our sport. When you have superstars like that, it is an odd situation, though. It is the one sport, it's the only sport I can think of where the athlete is worth more after their career than during their career. It is a little odd that that's the way it goes, but that's just the nature of our business. And so sometimes it just the situation calls for it to happen. It's got to happen.
So Coach, I know you've been a student of the game for a long time. Bill and I have been around for quite a while too. And we just said a little earlier that we thought the Pacific Classic was the single most dominant performance that we've seen in the sport since Secretariat won the Belmont Stakes. I mean, you have to be pinching yourself to be a part of a performance like that.
It was really breathtaking. Even all the grandstands at Del Mar, you know, usually if they're battling down to the wire, you hear the fans cheering and yelling, you know, to cheer their horse to the finish line. And this just, you know, when Fabian looked back and just kind of put it in cruise control, everyone just kind of stood up and clapped just with like respect and shock, just what they had just witnessed. And a lot of people told me that, you know, a lot of people that have been in the horse racing industry for a long time were all commenting to me that we'll never see another race like that in our lifetime again. That was the best they've ever personally been at. And that's just, wow, that's a real honor to be part of. And we feel very blessed that we can be part of this great horse.
Yeah, I mean, the buzz after the race was unbelievable. But I wanted to go back to, you know, when Flightline was first starting to train. I'm always curious about this with horses that are this good. I mean, there's very few horses that are this good, but horses that are really good. How early did he show it? Was he just blowing away his workmates from the beginning? Did it take him a little time to ramp up to race shape? Like, when did you guys feel like you had an inkling that you had a superstar potentially?
I remember seeing one of his early workouts before he even raced, and I was standing next to John, and Flightline was working out, and John turned to me and said, this is the best racehorse I've ever had in my barn in the last 35, 40 years. I've never had this kind of horse. And he's had some really nice horses. So that kind of took my breath away a little bit, you know, knowing John. And then John turned back again. He said, this is the best horse I've ever seen, period. Any barn, anywhere, just the way he travels. John knew really early. I'm still a rookie, and I can't see things the way he sees things. But yeah, John knew he had a really special horse the first time he saw him go around the racetrack. So once he shared that with me, then I guess I knew.
Costa, getting back to his campaign, only the five races, the Breeders' Cup will be the sixth. And a lot of it was due to bad luck. The whole fence incident, who knows, might have cost you winning the Triple Crown. I mean, that's certainly not inconceivable at this point. But how much of that was due to just this is the way modern horses are campaigned? How much of it was due to, like I said, bad luck? And how much was it due? Joe and I and several other people have used the term, maybe sometimes horses are too fast for their own good. They run so fast and so hard that they really do need a lot of time between races. You know, kind of take us through the decisions to run as sparingly as you have.
Yeah, again, I think that's kind of been Flightline's call because of his athletic ability, and he is so fast that the spacing is important. And again, John's done a great job with him in between races, teaching him and Juan Leyva, just constantly teaching him, you know, how to become a racehorse and how to go from 6 furlongs to a mile and a quarter. I got to give them all the credit. The plan was laid out quite a while ago, and it's come to fruition to see. Again, you've got a great trainer, though. And I've said this a few times, as blessed as we are to have Flightline, I think Flightline's really blessed to have John Sadler. He took his time. He didn't rush him, and he taught him how to be a racehorse. So I think we're kind of both blessed on that front. But it's just one of those things. And we'd love to run him more. We'd love to run him all the time. You know, again, back to the philosophy, we're always going to do what's best by the horse. And we're going to follow John Sadler's lead. And so this is where we're at today. And the plan has worked out A+. I mean, we couldn't have done it couldn't have been planned out any better.
So this is going to be a real softball question compared to Bill's, but you mentioned that your wife, Stephanie, was at the Saratoga sale when this horse was purchased. What's it like to be on this ride and be able to share it with your wife?
Oh, I mean, I'm really, really lucky. I don't know about other husbands that are in the horse racing business, but to have my wife, you know, jump on board, and she's just become, you know, she just started loving it more and more and more. And then she started joining some of the association. She's with Toba. She's with the TOC. She's with the Gregson on the backside, the Fashionable Fillies and all these other organizations, because she wants to help, you know, full scale from on the backside with the workers and the students that are getting scholarships all the donations. And so she's a hard worker. So I'm at the racetrack looking at races and horses and winning. And she's more full spectrum looking at the racetrack and the industry and everything's going on elsewhere. So yeah, I'm really lucky that she loves the horses and the track and the people as much as I do. That's I'm pretty lucky on that one. Yeah. So yeah, when I want to go buy another horse, that's no problem.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of is similar to my next question. So, you know, when athletes win championships or whatever, you ask them a question like, where does this rank? And they'll say, you know, next to my kids being born, next to getting married, this is like the greatest day of my life. Where does Saturday rank in your life?
I mean, it's horse racing and we understand that. And yeah, that was our, I still remember when the Breeders' Cup with Accelerate, that was, I mean, that to me, winning the Breeders' Cup Classic is like winning the Super Bowl within the World Series. I mean, because you have all these great races with all these great horses that day. And then there's that pinnacle race to me, the mile and a quarter on the dirt against the best in the world. And of course, I'm a little slighted because that was John's first Breeders' Cup. And so to be part of that with him and being with him from day one, and he's our only trainer and we've become good friends and to be part of that, the Hronas family's been very blessed. I know Brother Pete, he's always texting John if he's not at the racetrack, and they're always talking and congratulating and after Flight Lines race the other day, Stephanie went right by me and hugged John. I mean, I got missed. So yeah, that was a great, great moment in horse racing. And like Randy had said earlier, you know, when I had Accelerate, they said, you know, this is the greatest horse. I've actually heard that a few times with Lady of Shamrock. I heard it with Stellar Wind, you know, you got a great horse, enjoy it, because these don't come along very often, and then Accelerate, and then now Flightline. So we've been really blessed and really fortunate, and we've at the same time put together a good team, and I think we've had good philosophy and moving forward, and we've been trying to make this hobby, which turned into a business, a successful venture for us.
Costa, I want to go back to the Secretariat Flightline theme. Where were you on the first Saturday in June in 1973? And you said you've only been involved in horse racing for about a dozen years. Were you at that time? And please tell me that you weren't born. I don't want to make you a lot older than you are.
73, I was a sophomore in high school.
Okay, you were a sophomore in high school.
I was probably playing sports or chasing girls.
Were you a racing fan back then? And how aware of Secretariat were you back then? And then, of course, as the years went on, you became more racing. And I can't imagine anyone ever thought, I'll have the next Secretariat. That's just something nobody can ever even imagine.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. We become race fans at a really young age. Our mom was born and raised in Pasadena. So we'd go down and see the grandparents. And our family outing was at Santa Anita Racetrack. So just kind of fell in love with it from that point as a youngster. And then when I was 16, I could drive. So I would drive to Santa Anita. I wasn't old enough to bet, but I'd go and watch the races. So, yeah, me and Brother Pete were fans at the beginning, and we really enjoyed going to the racetrack. And, yeah, the Secretariat thing, and, you know, we watched it on TV, and it was – you don't really appreciate it because we weren't really involved in the sport like we are now. So I really – I don't know if we even knew that was that – big a deal at the time until we read about it the next day in the paper about it. So again, no internet, no nothing back then. So yeah, you had to wait until the LA Times came the next day to read about it. So Yeah, I don't think we had a great appreciation for it at the time when we watched it. Just where's everybody at on the TV screen? So it seemed like, wow, this guy's really good.
So I don't have any notes in front of me, Kosta, and I may be wrong about this. If I am, I'm sure they'll edit this out and it'll never see the light of day. Was it an usher, if I'm not mistaken, at Santa Anita that first hooked you up with John Sadler?
Yeah, me and Brother Pete were in the box. We had a box every weekend, so we were sitting there in the box, and it was January of 2010, and I turned to Brother Pete and I said, I think I'm going to claim a racehorse. And he goes, we don't know anything about this. I'm like, you know what? I think I want to do this. I think this would be fun. Just to get a racehorse. And you would come to the track all the time. I think I want to get involved a little bit. So our usher, Tony, very, very Italian guy, and he knew us because we had come to the track, you know, for a lot of years, and we had our same little seats. He's like, don't talk to anybody. Don't tell anybody what you just told me. Just, I'll see you next Saturday. I'll have an appointment for you. So we went back the next Saturday, and he said, okay, between race 4 and 7, I'm going to take you down and introduce you to John Sadler. I'm like, yeah, that's going to be a waste of time. You know, John's got Ike and Don Thrash, and he's got Jenny Craig. And I'm like, yeah, he's got great horses, you know, like Sydney's Candy, Twirling Candy. And oh, he had the Moss. He had Jerry Moss's horses. I'm like, yeah, this is not going to work out. I need something a little more scaled down. He's got, no, he's a Pasadena guy, and you're a Pasadena guy. Let's just go down. We'll just go talk. So as it turned out, you know, we went down, and I think we didn't interview John. John interviewed us. So and we met, and I think that Tuesday went down, had lunch with him, and then at that point we claimed our first horse in February 17th, 2010, named Sleep Tight. We got a valuable lesson. So Sleep Tight ran, I think got second. We came back a month later, claimed it for 40, came back a month later and ran as the favorite, got third, and then had to go, you know, to the farm for almost a year because that little tiny issues that John needed to address, and no surgeries or anything, but just needed some time off because I think she was 5 or 6. And then when she finally did come back a year later, they claimed her. So it's a valuable lesson.
Maybe you should name the horse Tony the Usher.
Yeah, exactly. No, you're right.
There you go. Yeah, you got a little baptism by fire there. Yeah, I mean, last question for me, just if Kosta Hirotas now could talk to Kosta Hirotas back then when you were just dreaming about claiming a horse, what would he say?
Wow. I guess it just, for what it's, I mean, I remember at the end of 2010, we had 3 horses, and I was like, wow, we got 3 horses now. This has gotten out of hand. This has gotten crazy. and then it's just little by little, Lady of Shamrock came along. We had a great year with Lady of Shamrock. And then at that point, I think we became believers. Like, this can be done. You don't have to be running a money fund for some company, or you don't have to have an oil company to do this. A couple of farm kids from Delano, California, can do this if they just get lucky. And we got lucky. And I guess Lady of Shamrock made us believers with her 3-year-old career. And we just kept kind of reinvesting. And it's just kind of turned into what it is today. I give Lady of Shamrock a lot of credit for building the stable, because she's actually the one that got us really started.
Kosta, thank you so much for coming on. It's great to talk to you. I really appreciate the time. And it's great to see what a nice guy you are. It's nice when nice happens to nice. So congratulations on all the success, and thanks for the time.
I greatly appreciate it. Greatly honored to be on with you guys. And thank you. And we'll keep our fingers crossed for Flightline to continue his career as successful as it's been going.
Well, absolutely.
Good for horse racing. Good for every owner in the country. Good for every racetrack in the country. I believe this might be the shot in the arm we need. So I really hope that we can continue this.
Yeah, we're hoping to. We'll get down on our knees and beg all the owners to bring them back next year.
Again, I think Flightline is going to get the final decision on this.
You're right. Absolutely. Yeah. I don't speak horse, though. But thanks. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Kosta Hirotas will receive a free 1-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
Why do the most successful owners, breeders, and horsemen select the Green Group as their tax advisor? We simply save them money and know how to make them more successful. Over the past 40 years, founder Leonard Green has owned and bred some of the best racehorses in the history of the sport. His in-depth, hands-on industry knowledge, combined with cutting-edge tax-saving strategies, has produced positive results for his clientele and has made the Green Group the top-rated accounting and tax firm in the business. For a confidential and complimentary consultation, contact us at 732-634-5100 or visit our website at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
The weekend preview is sponsored by Three Chimneys. This weekend, we've got a lot of action. It's closing weekend at Del Mar. Usually Del Mar used to close same weekend as Saratoga, but they're going a weekend further this year. So we have the Del Mar Debutante and Del Mar Futurity, which we'll get to in a little bit. But we're going to start off talking about the card Saturday at Kentucky Downs, which is a massive, massive card with six graded stakes races, all, according to Bill, our intrepid journalist here, worth $1 million.
No, five or six races are worth $1 million.
Okay. All right. Thanks for jumping in, Bill, fact-checking me. But let's run down the six graded stakes we've got, because it's going to be a great day of action. 12 race card. We've got the Mint Million, the Winstar Mint Million. That was canceled last weekend when Kentucky Downs had to cancel the rest of their Saturday card due to rain. We've got the Grade 3 Ladies Turf Stakes. We've got the Grade 2 Turf Sprint, which is a win and year in for the Breeders' Cup Turf Sprint. We have the Grade 2 Turf Cup Stakes, which is a win and year in for the Breeders' Cup Turf. We have the Grade 3 Ladies Sprint Stakes. And then we have the Grade 2 Franklin Simpson Stakes. So we have six graded stakes. The last five comprise an all graded stakes pick four. The pick four takeout is 14%. It sounds like such a shill for Kentucky Downs, but how could you not? Big fields, low takeout, turf racing. It really is a bettor's paradise. I think the biggest name that's going to run on Saturday, and Bill will love this, is Gaffoe. It's going to run in the Grade 2 Turf Cup going a mile and a half. Just 2 weeks. Two measly weeks after winning the Grade 1 Sword Dancer at Saratoga. So he's going to be a short price in there. Like I said, full fields. Every race has 12, 13, 14 horses. We've got some two-year-old stakes, I believe, there still coming up at Kentucky Downs. We got a Rest Me Red in the Turf Sprint. He's going to be a pretty big favorite. Shameless plug, I'm going to handicap the Turf Cup and the Turf Sprint on my Better Things episode later today as part of our Breeders' Cup partnership. Bill, any thoughts early on from these Kentucky Downs races?
Well, I mean, the overall story is the one you already touched on. The purses and just the astronomical amount of money given away. Other than the Breeders' Cup, is there any day in American racing? I don't think the Belmont card does, where there's five $1 million races on the card there. And, you know, the thing about Gaffoe, which is really cool, that he's running back 2 weeks. But the reason why is because he's not being campaigned as a stallion prospect. Now, he is not a gelding. He is a horse. But for a horse that is a marathon turf horse, there's really no commercial value to them, at least in this country, as a stallion. So Christophe Clément is going for the money. You know, he's going for the right thing here. And that's something we don't see too often. Also, again, we talked about it last week, too. And from a betting standpoint, there's just absolutely nothing like this. In 12 races on the card, 176 horses have been entered. Now, that includes also eligibles. They only run 12 at Kentucky Downs, which I suppose has something to do with maybe the course is narrow in some parts. Again, I'm going off on another tangent. I'd like to see them expand the course or widen it and run 20 horse races. How do you like? They have the horses to do it. Wouldn't that be the coolest thing in the world? Joe, the other story, well, there's a couple other ones. But Arklow comes back in the Kentucky Downs Turf Cup to go against Gaffoe. He won in 2020. He was second in 2021. Wesley Ward looks really strong. Campanella in the Mint Ladies Sprint coming back off a third place finish at Royal Ascot. And in the Franklin spot, Clément also has big invoice, having won six straight races coming into that big race. So just a wonderful card at Kentucky Downs. They don't have to go up against Saratoga, but they do have to go up against Del Mar. So that will take away the spotlight from them just a little bit. But from a betting standpoint and a good racing standpoint, deep fields, and also some really, really good horses, this will be the center of the racing universe on Saturday, with apologies to Del Mar.
Yeah, for sure. And I just wanted to ask Randy, too, like as a handicapper, like how do you approach these races at Kentucky Downs? Do you have anything specific that you look for?
I throw up a white flag when it comes to Kentucky Downs.
Exactly.
Kentucky Downs handicapping. I'm terrible at Kentucky Downs.
Yeah, me too.
But when you mentioned all the races and you mentioned the win and you're in for the Breeders' Cup Turf, I'll admit I just got on my formulator right here, DRA formulator, and I'm like, I guarantee you I know one horse who's going to be running in that win and you're in a mile and a half, Arklow. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at his lifetime past performances. He's won $3 million, right? This is his meal ticket. In 2018, he won this race, and he beat Bigger Picture, who was a nice horse by a half length. In 2019, he was second in the Kentucky Cup to Zulu Alpha. In 2020, he won the Kentucky Turf Cup and beat a horse called Red Knight. In 2021, last year, he was beaten a neck in the Turf Cup by Imperador. And now at age 8, here he comes back again, and he comes off a really good second-place finish to Rock Emperor in his comeback race. He hadn't run since October of 2021. This was at Saratoga. He was beaten a half length, and he had some traffic trouble in the race. So Arklow's primed and ready to go again at Kentucky Downs. I think he'll beat Gufo.
Mm. All right. Well, there you go. There's Randy's handicapping opinion, his lone handicapping opinion for the weekend at Kentucky Downs. You know, I think about the Turf Cup and, like, that used to be the real centerpiece of the meet. Like, that was it at Kentucky Downs and the old dueling grounds. Now you look at these cards and all these graded stakes races, and shout out to the graded stakes committee because they really have rewarded Kentucky Downs. And it's time for them to get a grade one, but overall they've rewarded Kentucky Downs for running these big fields and having these big purses. In general, we need fewer graded stakes in America, but this is a track that deserves more graded stakes and some grade ones as well. And I think that they've done a good job with that. I'm interested in Campanelle running too, because, you know, this is one of the few places in America where she's going to run as close to a full field as possible. She ran against 23 horses last time in the Platinum Jubilee, was a close third, beat 21 of those horses. I did the math correctly, I think. That was at Royal Ascot. That was against Boys as well. She's a really, really nice filly. She was also ahead second in the Commonwealth Cup against Boys last year at Royal Ascot. So she has done a lot in a relatively short career. She's only run nine times. She's won 5 times. So I'm really interested in seeing her. She's going to run in the Ladies Sprint Stakes, which is the second to last race on the card. Like I said, we have Del Mar as well coming up. We're going to get to that after the break. But this weekend preview is brought to you by Three Chimneys Stallions. Gunrunner had his latest graded winner over the weekend with Wicked Halo in the Grade 2 Prioress Stakes. The Winchell Thoroughbreds Homebred is now undefeated in her last 3 starts. She's been off the board only once in her 9 lifetime starts. Gunrunner also had a juvenile winner over the weekend with Red Route 1. It was another Winchell Thoroughbreds Homebred who broke his maiden at Kentucky Downs. Gunrunner has almost 30 yearlings in Keeneland September Book 1 alone, including, as we mentioned earlier, the full sister to Grade 2 Prioress winner Wicked Halo. How many of those Gunrunners are going to be in the top 10, top 15 yearlings? My guess is he's going to have like at least a third of them, because he's just absolute sensation. I'm sure everybody at Three Chimneys feels lucky to have him. So we'll be right back after this message from Three Chimneys Stallions.
Here comes Tama. Tama in the center of the track with good looking stride, squares off with Cyberknife. Cyberknife takes the lead. Tama going with him. These two in a thriller. Cyberknife just in front. And Cyberknife has won the TVG.com Haskell over Tama. Jack Christopher finished third. The running time, 1:46.24.
Gunrunner's on top of the world.
Come dream with us at Three Chimneys.
And it's all Tyler's Tribe to the final furlong. He's putting on another show tonight. He is 8 lengths in front. Now it's 10, now it's 12. Tyler's Tribe pouring it on as they come down to the line. He's going to win by double digits, and he stops the clock in 1:04.
All right, so like I mentioned, this weekend is closing weekend at Del Mar. It's a week later than it used to be because they started the meet a little bit later. We have the 2 grade ones for 2-year-olds. That's not all, though. We do have the TVG Del Mar Debutante, which is on Saturday, grade one for the fillies. And then we have the Run Happy Del Mar Futurity, which is on Sunday for the boys. We also have some other stuff at Del Mar to look forward to. We have the Del Mar Juvenile Turf Stakes, which is a grade 3 on Sunday. I think that's the first year this is graded, or maybe the second year. It's gotten some good horses in recent years, horses that have gone on to do okay in the Breeders' Cup. We also have the grade 2 John C. Mabee Stakes on Saturday at Del Mar. We have a couple other races at Kentucky Downs. We have a couple of stakes on Saturday, the ACS Ladies Marathon Stakes, the Untappable Stakes, the Nelson's Greenbrier Tennessee Whiskey Music City Stakes. Got through that in one beat. I'm a professional here. It's harder to write, I think, than it is to say. And then we also have some stuff overseas to look forward to. We have the Irish Champion Stakes this weekend. I think Mishriff is going to be in there. Vedeni, who's a very nice horse who's won some big races in France, is going to be in that race. We have the Prix Vermeil. It's in France as well, which is a group one. Del Mar has had a pretty good meet. I'm interested to see the handle when it comes out at the end of the meet, as well as the safety stats, because that's been a big thing. That's a big feather in the cap for Del Mar, I think, in recent years, is how few breakdowns they've had and how few injuries they've had. So I haven't seen any numbers yet from this meet so far, but I assume they're still chugging along in that regard, and they deserve a lot of credit for that. Oh yeah, I also want to mention the Wonderwear Stakes is on Sunday at Woodbine, which is restricted for Ontario bred 3-year-old fillies. Guessing that Moira is going to go in the Prince of Wales. I'm guessing
she's not. No, Joe, she's not.
Oh, go ahead.
They have confirmed they're passing the Prince of Wales, and they're going to run next in either the Cotillion or the Queen Elizabeth II, because they want to get graded stakes victories out of her. And obviously, you can't do that in restricted races in Canada.
Oh, damn. I mean, I would have liked to see her go for the Canadian Triple Crown, but I mean, yeah, I guess that makes sense. And you know, has she run on dirt yet?
I don't believe she has. Yeah. I think it's all synthetic, and she's never run on the turf either. So her next start, if it's one of those two, either way, it'll be uncharted territory.
Gotcha. All right. Yeah. So we'll keep an eye out for her wherever she runs. But yeah, definitely Del Mar, Kentucky Downs, the places to watch and be this weekend, especially Kentucky Downs with those fields. Like, you know, like Randy said, it's a tough nut to crack, you know, especially if you do multi-race wagers. There are so many landmines in those sequences, but you can make money within the race. Theoretically, you can make money because of the low takeout and the big fields. Yeah, I mean, that's all I can think about is the opportunity, but it hardly ever works out. Yeah. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by West Point Thoroughbreds. West Point is riding high after Flightline made history over the weekend. They also had First Captain finish third in the Jockey Club Gold Cup. And this week, they're going to have several performers at Kentucky Downs, including Cavalry Charge, who will run in the Grade 3 Windstar Mint Million on Saturday. Huge congratulations, obviously, to everybody at West Point and Terry Finley for Flightline's performance. Like I said, guys, this is what you spend all the money for. This is what you put in all the time for. So get a horse like this. You guys deserve it. It was great to see, and I hope all the partners, like I said, are still riding high after Saturday. So we'll be right back after this message with West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
Being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse. Every step of the way, when it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses, we are with your horse.
Just driving up down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can, because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Legacy Bloodstock. Legacy has almost 100 yearlings cataloged for the upcoming Keeneland September sale, including two Gunrunner yearlings and a Curlin filly. In book one, in book two, they'll have 10 go through the ring in the third session, including Hip 382, who's a Vino Rosso, half-sister to Grade 3 winner Cosmic Burst, and Hip 519, who's a Practical Joke, half-sister to Grade 1 winner Melatonin. Best of luck to Tommy and Wendy and the people at Legacy at the Keeneland September sale. We know you've been prepping for this for a while. Go see them. They will definitely take care of you. All right. It wouldn't be a TDN Writers Room without a Trainers Behaving Badly segment. And the Pennsylvania Racing Commission is making news all the time these days. They have been on a kill streak unlike any regulatory body I've ever seen in racing. Maybe you guys have seen something like this. Not me. Bill reported this story. Penny Pierce, who was a trainer in Pennsylvania, got suspended 1,950 days and got fined five figures because six of her horses tested positive for clenbuterol. Key here, out of competition testing, which I don't think is something that a lot of racing commissions and regulatory bodies do, but it's huge to catch potential cheaters. And Bill, I'm going to let Bill talk in a second, but he had an interesting point in his story about how Penny Pierce was like a 10 or 11% trainer. And then in the last year or two, suddenly she started winning at like 23, 24%, which instantly arouses suspicion. So I don't understand why trainers think that they can, you know, get away with being a new trainer overnight and not having so a little bit of scrutiny. Actually, I do understand why they do that, because no one cares in racing usually about these things. But the Pennsylvania Racing Commission does seem to care. They've gotten a lot of people suspended in recent months. Bill, what else did you think about the story?
Well, Joe, this is a messy one, and it goes beyond just the headline of the 1900 and some odd days. And you touched on part of the story, but there's even more to it than that. Penny Pierce was just a trainer you paid no attention to. She was an 11% trainer. She had been around for a while. I think I recall writing that the most winners she had in any year was 19%. In 2021, that all changed. All of a sudden, she was a 23% trainer, winning many more races. And I believe she's winning at 28% on the year. So what happened here? Well, it's not just, did she wake up one morning and figure out how to train horses? There's more to it than that. There was a trainer at Parks by the name of Ramon Preciado, who was another guy, you know, his unbelievable winning percentage, et cetera. And he had his license revoked back in 2016 for clenbuterol positives. Now, you're right about the Pennsylvania Racing Commission, what they've done lately, but in a decision that makes absolutely no sense, and they do deserve a lot of criticism for, they gave Ramon Preciado not a trainer's license, but they gave him a license to be a groom. I guess figuring as a groom, he couldn't get into that much trouble. Lo and behold, he was hired by Penny Pierce. So Ramon Preciado, the trainer that was had his license revoked, went into the employ of Penny Pierce. And virtually from that day on, that's when she became a totally different trainer. Draw your own conclusions.
Look, I know you guys have probably addressed, I know you have, I've heard you address this a lot, the abuse of clenbuterol, right? I think you had Mark Cassie on. I mean, I've had long conversations with Cassie about this. I don't want to call him a whistleblower, but he's been extremely outspoken in his belief that clenbuterol, since the phase-out abolition of anabolic steroids in the sport, that clenbuterol has been the single most abused drug in thoroughbred racing because of its steroidal qualities, right? And now, thankfully, racing jurisdictions around the country, some quicker than others, are starting to phase out the use of clenbuterol, some entirely. So, look, I don't know Penny Pierce. She may be the nicest person in the world, but I love the sport, and I have no sympathy whatsoever for Penny Pierce or any trainer that abuses clenbuterol and uses it as a performance-enhancing vehicle.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, how could you? And like I said, it's great to finally see some teeth behind the you know, regulatory rulings. It's not, you know, 10 days and a $500 fine. You know, I think about Peter Miller getting, what, 7 days for program training in California, like that kind of stuff that really just makes you depressed and cynical and feel like, you know, there's no cops on the beat and there's no people who actually have the stomach to punish people in racing for these kind of egregious offenses. And yeah, so how could you have any sympathy? I just wanted to mention this other story too before we go real quick. Drafted, who was a horse who ran fifth in the Forego Stakes. The owners of Drafted have, I'm quoting from Bill Finley's story here, the owners of Drafted have appealed a ruling handed down by Heise that could cost them $26,000 in purse money because their jockey, Luis Castro, violated Heise rules regarding the use of the whip. Nyra stewards determined that Castro hit the gelding 10 times during the race. Under Heise regulations that have been in place since July 1st, a rider cannot whip a horse more than 6 times. According to the DRF, under Heise rules, if a jockey strikes a horse 7 to 9 times during a race, there's no loss of purse. Instead, the rider is fined and suspended for 1 day. And when a jockey hits the horse 10 to 13 times, the jockey receives a 3-day suspension and the horse is disqualified when it comes to purse earnings. I'm curious what you guys think about this, because I saw a lot of uproar about this, and you know, obviously they're appealing and trying to get this overturned. I think what the spirit of the rule and the intention behind the rule is potentially scenarios where the owners tell the jockey, listen, just hit the horses many times so you got to hit them. We will pay your fine. We will pay for the loss of mounts for a day. This way, they tell the owners basically, no, well, you're not going to get the purse earnings either. On the other hand, the owners don't really have anything to do with if that's not the case and they're not instructing the jockey to do this, the owners don't really have anything to do with what the jockey does when he gets on the back of the horse. The jockey could have been acting on his own. So I'm not sure where I fall on this. What do you guys think?
Well, you don't have to like the rule, but the rule is there. And, you know, look, the owners of this horse, everybody's entitled to appeal and that sort of thing. I don't know what their defense would be. I mean, nobody's saying, so if you hit the horse more than six times, there's a penalty. And if you hit him the amount of 10 times, there's a penalty that includes the taking away of the purse. I don't know what their defense would be. I don't think anyone said, no, you got it wrong. You only hit the horse five times. And Joe, you brought up the point too, which is very salient in here. Again, you don't have to like the rule, but if you're going to have a rule like this, I think you need this kind of deterrent. Again, let's get to the Breeders' Cup Classic with $6 million on the line. And at the 16th pole, two horses are locked in battle, neck and neck. And the jockey on one of the horses, you know, thinks that the only way I'm going to win this race is to continue to hit this horse and whip it. You know, then you're going to say, then you're going to fine the guy $100 or suspend him 7 days or something like that. Well, he'll take the 7 day suspension. He'll take the $100 fine and throw caution to the wind because he wants to win the race. So I think you do need this kind of deterrent in place. It's also relevant that the jockey that did this is a guy, I haven't heard of the guy. I mean,
he's like a low percent rider in New York. He's like,
That is not used to riding in big races, you know, not riding every day. I don't think, you know, this would have happened to a top tier rider in New York because they know the rules. They follow, they're now used to riding in these instances. So, it's a tough pill to swallow for the owners. But at the end of the day, I think they're going to lose their $26,000.
I mean, look, I'm a fan of whip rules in general, even though they're very hard to administer. I know we've all probably talked to people who don't know that much about horse racing, who maybe want to get into it. And they say, well, look, if horses love to run so much, then why do they have to be whipped? It's a visual that in 2022 is a lot more difficult to explain, given the animal rights situation right now in this country, than it was 25 years ago. So I completely understand why tracks are going to whip rules. But to Bill's point, which I completely agree with, if you're going to have whip rules, they have to have some teeth. There has to be a credible deterrent to riders, or else they're not going to pay any attention to the rules at all if they're locked in battle in a big race. So short of disqualifying a horse on the spot and penalizing bettors, which to me is pretty debatable, I think the loss of purse money for the owners, as unfortunate as it is, because owners already are in a pretty difficult spot financially, I can't see any other reasonable deterrent, and the rules there, so enforce it.
All right, this week's Remy cartoon is pretty timely considering the jockey violations we were just talking about. It's a jockey talking to a steward in the booth, and the steward says to him, "Sorry, Jorge, but claiming executive privilege won't work in this instance." Very newsworthy. We had tipped already. All right, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. The Keeneland September sale begins next Monday, September 12th, and runs through September 24th. You can check out the catalog with over 4,100 yearlings at the World's Yearling Sale. com. I want to thank Bill Finley, our very special guest, Randy Moss, our Green Group guest of the week, Costa Hironis, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Petruniak, and our editors, Anthony LaRocca, Aaliyah LaRocca, and Nathan Wilkinson. Thank you so much for watching. We'll see you next week.